Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Ani Zonneveld. She is a Malaysian-American singer, songwriter, activist, and writer based in Los Angeles. She's released full albums of her own, including Ummah Wake Up, One, Islamic Hymns, Celebration of Life, and she's produced for other artists and participated in the writing of Grammy-winning songs. She's the first Malaysian to have won a Grammy. She is the president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, a nonprofit organization in the United States with affiliates in Canada, Europe, Chile, Australia, and Malaysia, creating inclusive communities that welcome and supports interfaith marriages, gay marriages, gender and sexual minorities, as well as sectarian minorities. Zonneveld is also the co-editor of Progressive Muslim Identities, Personal Stories from U.S. and Canada, a 2011 anthology that features a diverse group of progressive Muslims. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Ani Zonneveld. Hello, Ani.
Hi.
We had a great conversation last week. Specifically, I think most of the show we talked about the difference between the moderate and conservative Muslim voices here in the United States and around the world, and your progressive Muslim response to them. And I want to talk a little bit this week on the actual organization itself, Muslims for Progressive Values. What are the projects you're involved in right now?
We do a lot of work in building grassroots communities throughout the world. And we have an initiative called Imams for She, which is working with scholars of Islam and imams in several countries, and those imams that advocate for women's and girls' rights as a way to push back against the radicalism and against the misogynistic beliefs that has basically been a cancer in our societies. In the United States, we work a lot on a lot of progressive issues, not necessarily Muslim-related issues like women's reproductive rights, LGBT rights, separation of religion and state, fair sentencing of youth. We're a very different organization in that we don't focus on Muslim issues in the United States. We focus on progressive issues, which benefits all Americans, whether you're Muslim or not. So that's what makes us different. As an organization. In the United Nations, we challenge human rights abuses in the name of Sharia law, as justified by many of the Muslim majority countries. So when they justify child marriage, we challenge them. So, well, that is actually nothing to do with Sharia law. That is a cultural practice because the Quran clearly states marriages between two consenting adults of sound mind. And, when they justify punishment for apostasy, again, we challenge them on the basis that, well, the Quran is very clear, verse 256, there is no compulsion in faith. So all these political tool or Islamic justifications for political agenda, we debunk those justifications at the United Nations, and which is really powerful because it really makes people sit up, and it challenges the status quo at that international level. At the grassroots level, we work with our partners in Burundi, in Tunisia, Malaysia, Australia, the Philippines, the Netherlands, and it's basically pushing back against a lot of the anti-Islam sentiment and also pushing the progressive interpretation of Islam. And it's really interesting. The dynamics are really interesting. In a country, a secular country like Tunisia, for example, they are very conflicted. They have a very bad experience, and this is most of the Muslim country like Pakistan and the Arab world. You are either an Islamist, very conservative, misogynistic interpretation of Islam, or you tend to be secular, where you have such a traumatized issue experience of Islam, and you want nothing to do with the faith. And so we are stuck in the middle in that atmosphere, which is actually really, really even more challenging in the United than in the United States, actually. Because here I go to Tunisia, which is supposed to be a Muslim-majority country, and yet we have to argue against the secularists themselves to say, hey, I'm Muslim, I have the right to use an Islamic human rights language to defend human rights. And it's not just a secular language. And for them, it's very, and for many Muslims, it's very hard to wrap their head around that, because that is not what we were taught. So our work is I'm very satisfied with the work that we do, and I'm very proud of the work that we do. And throughout the years, this is our 10th year of existence, our network has grown, and what we're finding is there are more and more progressive Muslim organizations popping up throughout the world, and many of them are even borrowing from our 10 principles. And so our next step is to bring together all these progressive Muslim organizations at a conference later this year toward creating an umbrella coalition organization. And we will be registering ourselves in Geneva, and we will be the bloc, the progressive Muslim bloc, that will be upholding progressive interpretation of Islam against the human rights abuses in the name of Islam.
Now, don't you find an ally in the moderate to conservative American Muslim community when it comes to some of these things? I mean, I know a number of Muslims who are very conservative or moderate, if you will. They identify as such. They don't believe in child marriage. They don't believe in honor killings. They don't believe in extreme renditions of Sharia law. Can you work with them on those issues?
I would be very happy to work with them. The only problem is they don't step up. They may express their views privately in a very progressive way. I've had that experience, but they don't preach it. I can't do anything about that, and they can't do anything about that. So unless religious leaders are willing to have a bit of a stiffer backbone and to stand up for their principles, come on, I'm the door is always open. And what's really amazing with our Imams for Shia initiative, we have more Imams in the Muslim world that are completely at risk when they preach for women and girls' rights. I mean, I'm talking about death threats. I'm talking about people getting killed for speaking in progressive, egalitarian terms. But they are willing to verbalize, to stand up for their principles, whereas those here in the United States are very sheepish about it. So frankly, I have no respect for people like that.
Do you have any communication or relationship at all with the two Muslim organizations that I think probably get the most press, and that would be CARE and ISNA?
Well, CARE and ISNA know our positions very, very well, and they are not interested in working with Muslims for progressive values. And, you know, CARE has made these statements about being supportive of LGBT rights, for example, and this is obviously a post-Pulse shooting in Florida. But that's, you know, my question to both these organizations, so what have you actually done for LGBT community? Because actually, they've been our adversaries for all these years, so it's really good to see them actually give that lip service for such a cause. But what actually have you done? And that's where that support ends. That's where I think progressives, the non-Muslim progressive organizations and entities need to ask these Muslim organizations some hard questions. Oh, that's great. What do you do actually for women's reproductive rights? What do you do for women's rights actually? What is your program? What do you do for LGBT rights? Let's be honest about this. And I'm not getting this. I'm really don't get the sincerity from the non-Muslim progressive camps. I think they have been betraying their progressive values when they don't ask those hard questions.
I was just going to say that you probably
do get frustrated with many of the people on the progressive side, the secular side, or the even the interfaith side of this conversation, because they're just so afraid that they're going to offend the majority of the Muslims in their community by not asking the hard questions. But clearly you do, because that's what you're telling me.
What's really sad is that since the Pulse shooting, you've got blatant lies by these religious leaders, and they framed it in such a case, in such a way, in an op-ed that they had published, that if you challenge our Islam, you are anti-Muslim. And that is such a cop-out, because the shooter, Martin, he was filled with self-hatred as a homosexual Muslim. And that didn't come out of a void. That came from years of self-hatred taught by a self-hating theology, homophobic teachings. And our initiative after that was say no to homophobia and challenging religious institutions and educators to do away with this homophobic teachings. It has no place in Islam. And, it hasn't been very successful.
Tell us.
But we're still, pushing. And I want to make something very clear, though, because our work on LGBT rights in the United States is very different than our work on human rights in the rest of the world. Because for the rest of the world, on this issue of LGBT rights, it is really just about, in the Muslim world in particular, is about human dignity. Just because you're born homosexual does not mean that you should be discriminated. You should have dignity, because that is what the Quran is about. It's about dignity, and it's about human rights. And truth be told, when the Muslim majority countries accuse us of, oh, you're just an American tool, promoting LGBT rights. But our pushback to that is, hang on a second, you didn't have criminalization of homosexuality before colonialism. You didn't have these laws, and they cannot answer to that, because it is the truth. Truth is, homosexuals have contributed to Muslim societies in positive ways, as leaders, as poets, as artists, as scientists, and so on and so forth. They were never discriminated against, but they didn't live their life openly. It was more along the lines of don't ask, don't tell. But they were never killed for being homosexuals. And that's the difference between the Muslim world then and the Muslim world today.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Anne Zonneveld. She is the president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values. So tell us, as you did last week, you brought up several issues of controversy in Islam, and you provided the progressive interpretation. So where do these people, where does the conservative base of Islam get their understanding of homosexuality, and where do you get yours? How do you argue against what they say?
Islam or religion in general can be interpreted in many different ways. There's the hate texts and there's the loving and compassionate texts. People accuse us, the conservatives accuse us of picking and choosing our Islam. Well, sure, we pick and choose the good stuff. What's wrong with that? You pick and choose the hate stuff. That's the problem. And that is the problem with the Muslim world right now. I mean, look at it. It's a disaster. Why? It's a disaster because of the theology of hate. And you have promoted that. And it did not, this cancer did not come out of a void. It came out of funding. It came out of people actually subscribing to this hate of theology, this supremacist ideology. And this is the context from which the Muslim world is in now. It's destroying itself. It's unsustainable. And so when we pick out the good, loving, compassionate Islam, which, God is the most merciful, Well, human beings, sure, Muslims are sure not, you know, exemplifying that mercy, that mercy and compassionate that is that speak that the Quran speaks of. So it's hard to argue with those that are filled with hate. You know, we can only provide that alternative, loving, compassionate Islam that is in the Quran, but that many Muslims are actually seeking and wanting to reconnect with, because especially Muslims in the Muslim world, you know, living with hate is not a pleasant way to live your life. And instinctively, for example, when we do workshops in the Muslim world on empowering women and girls' rights, instinctively they know, the women know, and even the men know, like, you know what, this verse of the right for me to beat my wife, you know, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't feel right. But when your imam is saying to you, is preaching, yes, you have that right, and women have to put up with it, they don't have a theological way of pushing back. So we give them the tools. We teach them, like, no, actually, this is your right as a Muslim woman, and this is what men need to understand. It is so powerful and empowering for both the women and the men to know that on an individual level, that they don't have to listen to this distorted and violent interpretation of Islam.
How about the...
And if we can do that, it is incredibly... that is itself a shift. Let me go one step further in this explanation why this is so important. This loving and compassionate Islam that we hope eventually will change people's hearts and minds. When people's hearts and minds change, they will vote for a representative that reflects their values. This is what happened in America too. You voted for someone who represents your values, positive or negative. If we want to change the Muslim world, we have to change each individual's hearts and minds. And hopefully they will have the democratic means to vote for a representative that is reflective of their values. And hopefully then we will get a Muslim world that is peaceful.
Agreed. Last week we talked about the idea of when going back and looking at Islam, looking at the Quran, that progressives have what I think is a very wise and appropriate viewpoint, that there are some verses that are simply, that was then and this is now. For instance, when you were talking about the killing of unbelievers and the reason for that even being in the Quran, what about the verse that indicates that if you're looking for witnesses to a crime or something, that you need two women to equal the witness of a man? Is that something that holds water?
No, it doesn't hold water anymore. 1,400 years ago, the Quran was revealed in a society that was incredibly brutal, incredibly unjust. And this was a society, you know, even in some societies now in the 21st century, women are still the property of men. In some Hindu, in India, for example, when the woman marries, she belongs to the property of the husband. So in some societies, we still have this mindset, and to a lesser degree and to some degree, it's even worse, depending on where you're at. But 1,400 years ago, it was awful. Women were the property of the family, of the brothers and the father, and then when they were married, they became the property of the husband. They were always properties. As a matter of fact, this context of marriage is also almost equal to the mindset of slavery in ownership of a woman, ownership of a slave. So the Quran actually gave women rights. And this is really profound, that the Quran in 1,400 years ago, when women did not work, were not educated, were not allowed to be educated, the Quran advocated for that. The Quran gave women the right to work outside the home, gave the woman the right to keep whatever she earned for herself, and marriage was where she she had the last say of who she wanted to marry. And on top of that, she actually decided in a contractual agreement called, you know, a marriage agreement, where she decides the context of her. It's almost like a prenup, I suppose you could say, where she can dictate, if you want to marry me, you cannot have wife number two, number three, number four, and that I will be allowed to go visit my mother on my mother's birthday. You know, these, whatever it is that she wants to dictate to make her life and to make her marriage a good one for herself, she could dictate that in this agreement. And that is actually what marriage in Islam is. So the fact that you have this two men versus one is an example of, well, at least there is one woman, but that is 1,400 years ago. Now we have women who are incredibly educated, completely capable of being worthy witnesses. And I think that context of including women in itself was the progress for its time. But that is the starting point. It is not the end point. And that is the difference between progressives and those conservative and radicals. They're stuck in the times of 1,400 years ago as the absolute and full stop, period. No more changes. Whereas we look at the Quran as the starting point towards change.
It's interesting because several years ago, I attended a panel discussion that was put on by one of our local colleges, and it featured a panel of about five or six people from a local mosque. And these were definitely moderate conservative Muslims. And somebody in the audience posed that verse in the Quran to the panel, saying, is this correct, that you need two women to witness as opposed to one man? And this one gentleman, I think he was from Egypt, he provided the most convoluted explanation of that. At the end of it, I'm sure nobody knew what he was trying to say, but he was trying to justify it, but he couldn't really. Made an effort. Do you find this is something I've?
Let me say something, Tara.
Yeah, sure.
Quick. You know, when people are honest, they will give you a quick, straight to the point, honest answer. When people are not, that's when the convoluted response enter into the conversation, and you can spot that a mile away.
A point taken, absolutely. This is something that I've noticed. Tell me if you think that there's legitimacy in this. That if you look at the very conservative flanks of all of the major religions, you don't see them coming together. You don't see the very conservative Jews, Christians, Muslims, etc., all coming together to work for common good very much. But you do see the progressive, if you took all of the progressive Christians, progressive Jews, progressive Muslims, etc., they tend to work together. Am I correct? Do you find yourself working with these populations?
Yes, absolutely. It is correct in our context. Most, 99% of our partners are all non-Muslim organizations that advocate for progressive issues that benefits all Americans. The conservatives, I think, tend to have a very tribal interpretation of their faith. It's all about them. So they therefore, they're more isolationist in their theology. I'm generalizing. However, there have been some exceptions to that rule. For example, in France, when they were about to pass marriage, same-sex marriage in France, the ultra-Orthodox Muslims and the ultra-Orthodox Jews were out in droves, in the thousands, walking the streets, demonstrating against same-sex marriage. So in some instances, there are some common values
absolutely
that cross them out together.
Yeah, sure. And same thing with some evangelical Christians and Orthodox Jews when it comes to Israel.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very true. If people are interested in learning more about Muslims for Progressive Values, websites, other media that you would recommend?
I would really encourage everyone to sign up to our monthly newsletter. You can do that on our website because it gives a really good caption of what our activities are in the 1 month, our achievements and landmarks and what is coming ahead. It's a very good way to keep abreast of what Muslims for Progressive Values is doing, not just in the United States, but our work at the United Nations and our work through our local chapters. And, of course, there's Facebook. We have our corporate page. And we also have several group pages that are private, actually, where there is a very healthy debate about Islam and social issues of the day. Twitter, of course, all through the social media, but a lot of that information is all on our website.
Any major conference? Well, you mentioned the conference coming up towards the end of the year, I think you said. Tell us a little bit about what you're expecting there.
The umbrella organization is going to be called Alliance of Inclusive Muslims, AIM. And it revolves around three principles: human rights for all, freedom of expression, freedom of and from religion and belief. And as a result of all my years of working on social activism and Islamic human rights, I've come across a lot of progressive Muslim organizations, and everyone is really keen on coming together as a coalition for us to be working together and to effectively roll out programs in a more consistent manner, because everybody is working on pushing back against radicalism in our own pockets, in our own communities, but it hasn't been effective because we're so disconnected, and a lot of times we're reinventing the wheel over and over again when we shouldn't be, because that's a wasted resource. So what we're trying to do is to uniform, to collaborate in a lot of the efforts so that our work is more effective on a global scale. So that's one of the ways of us collectively making our world a better world.
Wonderful. Ani, thank you so much for your time today and last week as well. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Fred.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Ani Zonneveld. She is the president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values. Please join us again next week